Blog Talk Radio.
Come shine your light, open your heart, show us your gift that sets you apart. When you believe, then you can see that you are the star of your own destiny.
Hi, and welcome to the Honoring Hour. Today is it's not even March. I'm ahead of myself. Today is still February. It's the 23rd. I tell you, I haven't been able to figure out what day of the week it is this month. I've just had such a crazy month, and I hope that you all are enjoying whatever is going on in your life today and this week and this month and this year, because it's a fantastic time to be here experiencing the planet. I wanted to let you know of a couple things going on. You may have listened to the pet communication show that we did with Karen Wrigley. Karen and I are teaming up to do some Experiencing You retreats. We're having a one-day retreat coming up April 30th at Smith Mountain Lake in Virginia. And we also have some mini meets going on, which we're trying to get together. The first one is going to be March 10th. That's going to be via teleconference. And you can get on there for a quick message from your animal, totem animal, a healing. It's going to be whatever simply comes through. And there's going to be two different options. You can call in and speak directly and ask some questions and have some interaction, or you can just get on for the messages that's applicable to the group. The group energy will draw in specific messages for those that are here to listen. So I'm going to be posting some information about that on the Honoring Hour. As I finalize it, you can check the main website, www.thehonoringhour.com. You can also go to www.thehonoringhour.com/experienceyou.html, and that will take you to the information we have about the Smith Mountain Lake Retreat. The first mini meet is going to be March 10th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. So we hope that you guys will join us. That is going to be teleconference. The retreat, however, is in person. And it's filling up fast. It's limited space so that we can make sure everyone has personalized service. We hope that you'll join us. All right. So just wanted to tell you about some stuff coming up. We've got Julie Hoffenberger, who is from Authentic Women Coaching. She's going to be with us in March, and we have Sid Corpy talking with us about good grief, finding peace after pet loss. A lot of people overlook that, and really losing a pet is very significant, so she's going to be talking to us about that. And we're going to have the fantastic Stephen Victor back on, who really knows his stuff and can shake up some energy, so we're excited to have that. Today, I have on here a fantastic individual, a dear personal friend. She's a wealth of information, a wonderful supporter of so many people. She's here helping out in the world, and she's just a great, great person to know. I'd like to welcome to the show today Michelle Miller.
Fantastic. How are you, Michelle? Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'd like a copy of that.
Well, you can have it in our archives.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So, how Michelle, are you today?
I'm good. I'm really good. It's been a busy day, but it's great. I could have you on here. We talk about so many things so often, and I could have you on here for probably a million different topics. But I have finally talked you into coming on here to discuss with us limbic resonance. And what I'd like for you to do, if you don't mind, is just tell us in like a real plain Jane language what limbic resonance is.
Well, limbic resonance, it's really the unspoken harmony of the heart that resonates between two individuals as their eyes meet. It's based on the idea of the mammalian brain, and basically humans, mammals, when their eyes meet, they have this harmony, this emotional connection that gives so much information that's unspoken, nonverbal, and really helps us to regulate and become in harmony with each other. It's one of the theories that is behind love at first sight, and it's also behind, you know, mob mentality. When we're connected to people, when we meet eye to eye, we start to actually become in tune and in harmony with each other. And that in tunement and in harmony helps us to understand where the other person's at, gain their perspective, and make an emotional connection that allows us to kind of regulate ourselves and really move into that relationship moment.
So one of the things that I heard you that jumped out at me initially was when your eyes meet. So it's important to, in order to, like, utilize limbic resonance, in order to make that harmony, it's important for people to make eye contact.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that's so interesting is through my studies in psychology, you know, I'm reading a lot of literature about empathy in our society and how there was a major research done. I believe it was either at Michigan or Minnesota State. And they're finding that, you know, the children or young adults in college are rating an absence of empathy. It's actually going down. And some of the theories behind this are stating that with so much technology, you know, Twitter and Skype and all this kind of stuff, people really aren't making eye contact. They're meeting each other technologically. And, you know, studies have shown that, you know, doing all of your relationships over the internet and being on the computer a lot and spending time on video games actually leads to depression because you're not making that emotional regulation connection with another human being that's so essential to our survival. Several studies were done on infants, and they took infants and they put them in a room and gave them no emotional contact. And in the study, all the infants died. Our connection to other people, one-on-one, face-to-face, meeting eye contact, is essential to our survival.
Wow. What a horrible study.
Yeah, I know. Way before ethics came in, many, many years ago, but... You know, I know, I agree with you. You know, but they've also seen this with, I believe it was in Bosnia or another country like that. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact one, but there were so many orphan infants that were left behind, and there was not enough caregivers to care for them, and they suffered irreparable damage due to the absence of care, and really when they were adopted out, had difficulty attaching to their new parents. It's so important. It's one of the things that underlies that connection between mother and child or father and child. And they're finding that connection, you know, that eye-to-eye close proximity actually regulates the child physiologically. And, you know, in our society, especially American society, you know, we tend immediately to put the child in their own room. And, you know, the parents, unfortunately, both parents have to work. And so the child goes to a daycare and spends a lot of time there. And then when the parents get home, they're super busy and really aren't able to make those one-on-one connections with their children. And they're finding an attachment theory that those one-on-one connections are so incredibly important for the development of that child. And it really shapes their relationships and who they choose as love partners later on in life.
Huh. So what is happening? I mean, I don't know if this is getting too physical. What is actually happening in the brain with that connection? Do you know that, or is that, like, not your area of expertise?
Well, you know, I can give you an overview. That's a pretty intense discussion on the physiology of behavior. But basically, our limbic system is in charge of our emotions and our motivation. And when we make eye contact, when we're in the proximity of another individual, it actually makes neural connections. And through those neural connections, you know, we also have cognitions, our executive part of our brain. And in learning, we make these associations. And we start associating our personal regulation according to what is externally represented to us as children. So, for instance, you know, if you have a mother that, you know, meets your needs, you cry, she comes, she comforts you, that initial dependence and that parent or that caregiver that is teaching you how to regulate, like when the mother comforts the child, eventually that develops in the brain to teach the child how to regulate themselves, comfort themselves. And as time passes and as that is repeated over and over again, that child learns to be secure in love, that feels secure in being vulnerable and making connections. If that's not present in the body, then different attachments are made, and they're disorganized. And what happens is love can actually become a very frightening thing. Being vulnerable can be dangerous, and that's when you see people have difficulty being vulnerable, opening up, making eye contact, connecting to other individuals. And, you know, you've heard the story, and, you know, you and I have talked about this over and over again. You know, we hear over and over again, I keep picking the same relationship. I want something different, but I keep going into the same relationship. Well, a lot of that is influenced by the fact that what we're comfortable with, how our brains have mapped love, is what we look for, and it's what we search out. And though mentally we may say, I want something different, emotionally it just doesn't feel right to us. And so we keep getting in the same relationships over and over and over again. Now, I know that sounds kind of hopeless, but the truth is the brain is very plastic. And what is so beautiful and so wonderful about how we're created is we can actually change that. We can put ourselves in situations that may feel a little uncomfortable, and I certainly don't mean, you know, dive right into something that you know is cognitively dangerous, but, you know, really search out people with healthy rapports. You know, that's where mentoring is so important, or a great therapeutic relationship, and really learn to resonate in a different way with that healthy vulnerability, that open connectedness. And in time and through repetition, our brain will actually remap itself, and we will start to search out new, healthier relationships.
So this is something absolutely, and I remember when we first talked about this a long time ago, it kind of filed in my brain as, you know, resonating with that law of attraction stuff, because essentially that is, this is the chemical aspect to that law of attraction that we are hearing so much about through The Secret and everything else. I mean, this is the physical, the physiological part of that.
It's the mechanism of that, absolutely. You know, people hear, you know, I guess in a lot of these books it says, you know, make a map of what you want in life. You know, do a poster board with the pictures and things like that. And that's wonderful cognitively to look at something and say, yeah, I'd like that. But you actually have to sit in the feeling. And, you know, an author, Greg Braden, I can't remember the book, but he talks about prayer, and he talks about stepping into that emotional feeling of what it is you desire, that love, you know, sending out that energy and creating the emotion. That's what actually starts to shift in the brain. When you really sit in, this is what I want, what does it feel like? What would it be like to actually be there? You know, one of the most wonderful sayings is fake it till you make it.
Right.
Really sit in that emotion. And actually by sitting in that, you know, sitting in that presence, if you're looking for a better relationship, what would it feel like to be in that relationship? Really sit in that energy. And that will actually shift and change the chemical response in your body. So like with the law of attraction and The Secret, it's not enough to say, oh, I'm going to have this. You actually have to move into that space. And it's a slow process. You know, a lot of people say, oh, I'm going to put a picture of this house and or this job or this man, and it's going to show up. And then they become so disappointed because it's not there. Well, like everything in life, there's a process. There's a season. And it takes time to shift into that space. But once you start shifting in there, you'll start creating or manifesting more of that coming to you. And you'll get that repetition that the brain needs, that the body needs, and gives you the time to actually move into a full expression of what it is you truly desire.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is so important, and I hear that over and over again, you know, when I'm talking with the different people that I'm interviewing on the show. It, you know, it has certainly come up in the work that I do. It's so huge in the classes that I teach. But I read it over and over again in books, and that is feeling. You really need to get into that feeling nature. You know, those emotions really do drive, you know, they drive a lot. They speak out to the universe. I describe the emotions as like our megaphone to the universe. It doesn't matter what our mind might be chanting. If our emotions are screaming, then the universe hears that scream. And so, yeah, that whole feeling nature is bringing that in. And feelings and emotions are not necessarily synonymous, but definitely, you know, those emotions are prompted by feelings that we have. So I want to ask you this, because this is something that comes up in my line of work so often. If you've got a person who's just had, you know, from birth they didn't get what they needed and so forth, and you were just talking about how it takes time and you have to expose yourself. But when you're talking about, like, somebody that's just basically down and out to the point where eye contact is just so challenging for them, And when they sit in a place of starting to try to imagine something being different and feeling something being different, and they can only go for like seconds at a time in that before that internal core belief system starts to come in and take over, how would someone like that start to move out of where they are and allow that limbic resonance process to take over and start to work for them a little bit? How do they shift their limbic resonance from being that severe, you know, from one severe sex to another?
Yeah, well, and one thing, too, is, you know, in our work and everything, the most important thing is be gentle with yourself. You cannot force this to happen. And if you force it beyond what you can physiologically handle, it will be terrifying. And that almost it counteracts what you're trying to do. So the first thing I say is be gentle with yourself. I mean, if making eye contact, you know, in working with children with autism, that was such a difficult thing, so very overly stimulating. Many times the first steps we would take was just be in the presence of that person with compassion. You know, go be around people that emanate that feeling, and rather than trying to make that eye contact, just sit in that space. You know, for some people it's a beautiful church, or, you know, a place of nature, or, you know, for some it's a shopping mall, whatever works for you. But go and sit in that space and just allow yourself to feel that emotion and be a part of it, be present to it. And then just slowly move into, you know, make small goals. You know, today I'm going to meet the eyes of a stranger and not be frightened, you know, and allow myself that moment of vulnerability. And take time. You know, it takes time to remap the brain, especially if you've been in a very tragic childhood or experienced a tremendous amount of loss. Vulnerability can be very, very frightening. But it is possible, you know. And, again, remember, you know, some of the things you're going to feel comfortable in may not, you know, may more resemble what you experienced in the past. So be wise. Look for patterns of behavior. You know, cognitively, in your mind, get a really good idea of what is a safe person. What are some of the flags that trigger unhealthy relationships? And pay attention to those. You know, this isn't just dive in and be vulnerable and open yourself up. People do that all the time, and then they end up in these huge messes where they've overrided their good sense because they're trying to force this ability to connect, and it becomes a mess. So, you know, be wise, but be gentle with yourself and take time and really make sure that the people that you're surrounding yourself with really do have healthy emotional intelligence and can really take the time and not force you and be there for you and allow you to slowly move into that space.
So, you know, I was just sitting here thinking about that, and I was wondering how many professionals are out there that, you know, every professional in the mental health field is different and they practice differently. And I was just wondering how many professionals out there are aware of this limbic resonance and how many utilize it in their practice, because it definitely sounds like, I know when I was taking, you know, my college courses, this was not an issue that came up. And when you were talking to me about it, I was just so fascinated by it. And I mean, and with that study you were just talking about, you know, where the infants died, you know, obviously limbic resonance has been around, but it certainly wasn't in my line of college study, and it could just have been the curriculum that I was taking. But I would have really benefited from knowing this as a mental health worker a long time ago.
Yeah. You know, what's really funny is I came upon this when we first started talking about it. I was studying physiology of behavior, and it was just a tiny little blurb in my book, literally one sentence long, and nothing more was said about it. And it caught my eye, and I've done a lot of study into experiential therapies, bioenergetics, and also into what's called holographic reprocessing, which is kind of the emotional experiential part of cognitive behavioral therapy. And, you know, they're finding over and over again, unless you deal with the emotional body, the treatment is just not as effective as when you do. And they're actually finding that dealing with the emotional body is finding greater success with people with like personality disorders and avoidant behaviors. In the professional field, you know, we have this caveat of being detached. We're there professionally. We're not your friend. We're not your family. Creating this, you know, professional relationship with people. And unfortunately, I, you know, find so many therapists or counselors detach emotionally because they don't want to get attached and they don't want to cross the boundary. And I think it's really important as professionals that we really are emotionally healthy, that we know how to fully be present to our clients emotionally and cognitively and professionally without crossing those barriers, knowing how to be there and be present to someone without subjecting them to our own issues. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people are unable to really connect to someone without feeling threatened themselves. So, you know, like I said, I think the important thing is for, you know, the physician heal thyself, to really take the time to make sure we're in a good spot, a good place to actually be there for another human being, because the work we do is, it's another person's life.
Right. You know, Michelle, I am just so tickled to hear you saying that there's all this documentation out there about healing the emotional body, because as you know, that's my life passion, is to work with people on healing their emotional body. And it's like, yay, there's actually documentation out there saying, you know, my life's work is validated. It's not all in my head.
Well, actually, part of it is in your head. It's in your limbic brain. But,
That's right.
You know, it is true. And there is a tremendous amount of documentation coming out. There was a tremendous amount of research. Some great stuff that you would love to read is on holographic reprocessing. And it's all about cognitive behavior therapy. And, you know, as we know, what we think, we believe, and it creates our perceptions, and our brain is very good about creating our environment or helping us to create an environment through our perceptions that confirms our belief systems. And so, you know, that was kind of through the birth of cognitive behavior therapy, you know, on how we create associations, how we learn, how we interpret our environment. And what they're finding is that the emotional body is so powerful that, you know, thinking alone does not really change our behavior. We have to be emotionally present to that. And that's where affirmations came in. And they found that, you know, you can write out an affirmation for someone and hand it to them, and it will have no validity. However, if you can sit with someone, be present to them, and allow them to come up with their own affirmation, it's incredibly powerful because they have to actually feel it. They have to believe it. And be able to say that to the point where it resonates, not only, you know, the words cognitively, but emotionally. And, you know, tons of research has been done on genetics. And trauma is actually passed generation to generation genetically, affecting the way our neurochemicals are processed and how our brain makes connections. And, you know, so, yeah, there is an unbelievable amount of research out there about how valid the work you're doing is, and how essential it really is for complete and total healing. I mean, until we can actually feel comfortable moving into a new way of being, until our emotions are in line with that new way of being, we're in a constant state of fight or flight. It becomes frightening, and vulnerability becomes frightening. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this great social researcher that you would really enjoy, Brené Brown, and she talks about the most successful people in life, and not just monetarily, but emotionally. And she says the key to that is the vulnerability, the willingness to be known. And in that, they take risks. And through those risks, through that deep sense of knowing themselves, they can actually put themselves out there and make strong connections that change their whole world, that open up possibilities to them that otherwise they never would have seen.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I, you know, that is sounding amazing. I did want to ask you, when you were just saying that, though, and my brain just like went in a million different directions at one time, so I was trying to collect my thoughts a little bit, because, you know, I can just kind of go off into a whole tangent of conversation and, you know, eventually come back to what we're doing. But with limbic resonance, you were saying, you know, that some of this stuff is passed down genetically. So, you know, a child would not necessarily have to physically experience the trauma. It could have technically been passed down from a mother or a grandmother or grandfather or father. I mean, it's either sex. So, and then this child winds up with this idea, this way of operating in the world that was genetically passed down. So let's play with that for a minute and just how this limbic resonance process works. Let's say that a child has assumed a behavior characteristic that was passed down, and they're wanting to shift this. And how does that limbic resonance process work? I mean, if it can override the genetic predisposition, right? Because it wasn't that kind of what you were saying at the beginning, that it's creating what we're attracting to us, you know, is how we're taking that in. We can redesign that genetic predisposition.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you and I have talked about grace, and there's just so much grace in how we were created. Yes, we come in with, you know, a genetic history, and then we're in a family with a behavioral history that keeps getting perpetuated. And, you know, so many people now, especially I see, are really waking up to a new possibility. And it's absolutely possible to recreate. Our brains are plastic, and they're finding that they're plastic throughout adulthood, which means we can shape and reshape and reform our brain in the way we choose to operate in the world every moment. And really coming out of that and moving through that, you know, breaking those behavioral chains is a choice. And that's where free will comes in. And it's very uncomfortable initially. And being willing to sit in that state of being uncomfortable and unfamiliar to shift and change those behaviors is part of the process. You know, really, it's taking a chance. And again, finding someone or something that, you know, you can cognitively define as being safe, you know, and in many cases that could be a therapeutic relationship. And it's been known to happen in mentoring relationships. It's been known to happen in relationships with a pastor or a minister, someone who you really can sit in that space and talk about these feelings, these associations, and then have them explain things back to you, different possibilities, and sit with that for a while. And imagine what that would be like. And then seek out interactions with others. You know, some of the genetic stuff that goes down through generations, really you can overcome that through choice. Mm-hmm. You know, so many times people go into major depressions, and, you know, through changing their belief systems and being willing to step into, you know, vulnerable situations, you know, initially that have been really deemed safe, and then you start to learn what safe is. And then you start to actually seek out more safe relationships. And, you know, what I mean by safe is, you know, people who really want to connect and know you, not manipulate or control, who really respect who you are and who support who you choose to be. And really support you.
Right, and I just want to add to that, somebody that supports you and your authenticity. So
exactly.
with your quirks, you know, I mean, and they accept you. They don't have to approve, but they accept you in all the little, you know, authenticities that you have. So, you know, if you like to come in the door and kick off your shoes and you don't like them to be messy, you want your left one over your right one, they love you for that quirkiness. You know, it's whatever, or you know, it's just whatever, however you are, you know, and they're supporting you in good ways. That's what I think that you're trying to, in healthy ways, not necessarily good, because sometimes they're also going to be the people that are going to say to you, you know, have you really looked at that thought process? You know, they're the people that are there for you, and that's how you know if you found a safe place, when someone can say something to you and they say it out of genuine love, you know, and just compassion and with no judgment and just acceptance. That's a safe place for you to learn.
Oh, yeah. You know, so many times I see people go into, you know, even professionals go into therapeutic relationships with this idea that we're going to fix another person. And to me, that's ridiculous. People are beautiful and incredibly individual. And, you know, who am I to tell someone else how they need to be? You know, a supportive person will move into and resonate with you, move into the space of who you want to be, and help you to fully realize who that person is. You know, beautifully individual the way we were created. You know, if like you said, if I like my shoes lined up and you don't, neither one is better. You know, it's just who we are. And you're right, that quirkiness is what makes us so incredibly beautiful and perfect and wonderful to experience. You know, if I wanted everyone to be like me, I'd just stay home. You know, so yeah, it's really fully accepting a person's individuality. Those, like you said, the quirky, their uniqueness. Really experiencing that person as they are now, not how we wish they would be. Allowing them the time and the love to grow in the directions, and to falter and not blame or chide, or you know. Make them feel bad about that, but just show, you know, really as a loving supporter saying, hey, you did incredible here, you know, like Jeff Brown says, two steps forward, one step back, what's the new plan? I'm here to support you. And, you know, allowing them to live the life that they are looking for.
Right. Jeff Brown, the author of Soul Shaping, who was on our show the first year here on the Honoring Hour, fantastic book and a wonderful archive, and he's been on many shows. If you check out his website, soulshaping.com, you'll learn a lot, any of you guys that are out there listening in the archive land or in live land.
Yeah, one thing I really appreciate about him is really looking at that authenticity in the emotional body of the male. You know, I so many times when I work with families, I find that the men tend to move away from the emotional body and really move into that state of being, you know, the protector and, you know, being emotionally stoic. And there's such an incredible and such an important part of the family, of our community, you know, and having them really move into a place of full expression and feeling, you know, able to be vulnerable in our society and be authentic, I think is incredible. And I'm really excited about the movement and what I'm seeing happening there, you know, and with the men in our society today. You know, there's nothing unmanly about being emotionally present to the people you love. In fact, it's an incredible asset to our society.
Right.
And I'm really looking forward to the development of that and seeing how that really shifts and changes the dynamics of the world we live in.
Right, and staying in line with that whole eye contact thing and limbic resonance, it automatically made me, like as soon as you started talking about the work that he's doing, I just became acutely aware of your introduction to him. And it reminded me instantly, I'm like, well, how did that work? You know, how did the limbic resonance tie into how you met Jeff? And I remember distinctly, and I think he still uses a picture, he's got a profile picture on Facebook where it's of his, it's his face, but the focus of it is more on his eye area.
Yes.
And so it's just right there. So you actually get that connection with him, even though it's cyber. So
yes.
I don't know if he had planned that or not, but it was definitely a clever thing to do. I want to ask you, Michelle, just do you find or in your research have you run across where how limbic resonance plays throughout a family? I would imagine that it's a huge deal with families living under the same roof specifically, kind of getting in that same resonance. And I'm wondering, too, if when one or more of the family members start to make changes and make shifts, if there's any study or notice of, like, eye contact decreasing among the family members.
I don't know if there's any studies out there specifically surrounding eye contact, but there's a lot of studies out there surrounding and the relationship triangle. When someone moves out of a place of conflict and moves into that place of acceptance and stuff like that, it completely shifts the family dynamic. Now, keep in mind that, you know, when people grow up, if they've grown up in a dysfunctional home and it's been generational, initially it makes the other family members very, very uncomfortable. They don't know how to navigate it, and many times they will actually move to put things back to the way they used to be, even though they were dysfunctional and it made them unhappy because they're used to it.
Right.
And we're comfortable in what we're used to, and that's one of the things that perpetuates seeking out dysfunctional relationships. You know, why do I keep ending up here? Well, because you've become comfortable there. And, you know, if that individual can maintain and stay in that new state of being, they can absolutely shift that entire family dynamic.
Right.
But, again, it takes time. And, you know, and being willing to move through that feeling of being of isolation in the family. You know, imagine that in these families, these children, vulnerability and the need and the want for that love and connection is so powerful that, you know, they learn to seek it out dysfunctionally. And that's what we see a lot with children with negative attention, tantrums, oppositional defiant disorder, all that kind of stuff. It really comes from insecure, avoidant, or detached attachment styles. And it's what they've become comfortable with. It's the only way they know how to find love. And so, you know, to navigate a family, an entire family situation where you're now isolated because you're moving in a new way is very, very difficult. And, you know, that's where a lot of, like, support groups and things like that can be really beneficial, because you're actually getting that input, that positive input to really stay and maintain in this new way of being. And as you stay there, you know, like earlier I talked about mob mentality, well, there's a love mob too. You know, when you can sit in that loving place, you can shift an entire room. We're that powerful. Because really, you know, and I believe our true nature is love. And that's what we want to move into. It's why we're constantly seeking out connections, even when, you know, in our history, those connections are painful and are lost. But that moment of connection is so life-affirming that we consistently try and find it. So, you know, if you can be that person in the room or in that meeting or, you know, in that household that can really create that energetic resonance of compassion, acceptance, authenticity, you know, you can shape that room. And, you know, you and I see it all the time when we go into homes, you know, where the whole family dynamic is dysfunctional and there's not a lot of compassion, just holding that space for that family and allowing them to learn how to navigate in their individual way can completely shift an entire family's future.
Right. Right. And so often, you know, one of the things that's real key about shifting, you know, from one perspective to another, especially when you're in a home dynamic, or is if you're in a crisis or you're in fear or you're feeling overwhelmed, people have a tendency to go with what they know, which means they'll revert back to past behaviors, irregardless of what the consequences of those behaviors are, because it's familiar to them. We'll have a tendency to go with what's familiar. So if we could just be calm and, you know, and take it easy and take it slow step by step and utilize things like counseling services and support groups and, you know, even just, you know, healthy book reading, you know, just get into something that just helps, or, you know, changing, you know, to watching TV shows that are upbeat and positive instead of, you know, other things that are killing and negative and stuff. Any of that will kind of help shift that whole dynamic as well. Are there things like, when you were looking through the limbic resonance stuff and studying up on that, was there, you know, did they talk about how television or media impacts our limbic resonance?
Well, you know, really the one complete text on limbic resonance that I found that really goes in depth is the General Theory of Love. And one of their main proponents is therapy. But, you know, there has been studies on how media affects our thought patterns and stuff like that. But I haven't come across some really good definitive studies about how it really affects our emotional development. However, you know, in my work, you know, if I'm working with children with aggression and violence and things like that, it to me it's just intuitive to surround them with something different. You know, saturate them with life-affirming events, you know, and with a lot of people I work with, you know, I talk to them about meditation. I mean, it does have a tremendous amount of empirical proof for the ability to, you know, improve attention and reduce emotional anxiety. Breathing, you know, when you're sitting in that space where you're feeling vulnerable and frightened and it's something new, breathe deeply, you know, pull in, you know, that oxygen to help calm the fight and flight and help to relax the body. You know, exercise, moving into that, you know, healthy ways to support the body in stabilizing that positive life-affirming way of being. All these things can really help. But, yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, if I was working with somebody who had been surrounded by violence, the last thing I'd want to do is give them visual representations of that, because you figure when we look at things and we understand things, we start making associations. That's part of learning theory. And if you're trying to unlearn something and learn a new way of being, the last thing I would want to do is saturate myself with my old way of being, because that would just support staying in that space. So we definitely move it. Huh?
Yeah, that is so key. You know, that was just such a good point to bring up. You know, that if you're trying to make a change, saturating yourself in your old lifestyle or your old habits is going to be counterproductive.
Well, yeah, and unlike any behavior change, I mean, even quitting of addictions, they've proven over and over again that a change of venue is essential. I mean, if someone's coming out of prison or if they're trying to quit drinking or doing drugs, the last thing you're going to do is go hang out with people who do those things. I mean, they've even found that, you know, posting a picture with a drug needle on it or posting a picture with a cigarette with a line through it actually causes people to want to do that behavior more because there's so many associations linked to that picture of that cigarette or the picture of that drug. So now you'll see, you know, for people who actually understand the way the brain works, if they're doing campaigns that are anti-something, the last thing they're going to do is present that visually. You know, the whole part is we're trying to create new connections. We're breaking neural connections that lead us to the things we don't want, and we're trying to create neural connections to the things we do want. You know, you want someone to move out of an addiction, give them pictures of flowers or of what they want to move into, and saturate your mind, your heart, your body with the way that you want to express yourself in the world, not in the way you don't.
You know, I was just kind of, I was questioning, like, what part of the brain the limbic system was. So I was just looking it up as you were talking. And what's included in the limbic system is the hippocampus, the amygdala, the anterior thalamic nuclei, the septum, the limbic cortex, and fornix. But one of the things that really caught my eye is the amygdala.
Yes.
You know, that was just so huge to me because there's just so much that goes on, you know, in that area of the brain. So, and I was also looking at, you know, just the amount of emotion. It says that, you know, these seemingly support a variety of functions, including emotion, behavior, long-term memory, and olfaction. And it says the term limbic comes from the Latin limbus for border or edge. So, you know, I think that, you know, when I'm thinking about that and when I'm thinking about, you know, the limbic resonance talking about how they can, or, you know, how we get into empathic harmony, you know, that whole empathy, that ability to move into empathy, I think is something that people either tend to not have. Like I've observed, you know, through my work both professionally and in my life work, which is not necessarily my professional career at this time, but they're very similar. What I'm noticing is that people either are, they assume too much responsibility and they consider that empathy, or they don't have the ability to be empathic. So do you have any comments on how people, like, learn to be empathic or, you know, learn to utilize empathy in their life without assuming the responsibility or too much responsibility? Am I making sense with what I'm going there? Because my brain is, like, dancing about.
Well, you know, what's triggering in my mind is you're really kind of going into allowing someone to be authentically themselves, and then you're going into codependence. You know, if you're trying to manipulate or control or create an environment that involves another person, without allowing them to be authentically who they are, then you move into codependence. You start enabling. You start shifting who you are. In fact, you just become whoever they need you to be at that time. And you completely lose yourself. True limbic resonance and true authenticity allows each person to be completely authentically who they are and find a way to communicate, compromise, and find ways to navigate that as individuals but as couple. You know, so many times you see in relationships, you know, the wife or the husband starts telling the other person how they should be, how they must be, or, you know, in many nurturing situations, that person denies self. And selfishly, which I think, you know, selfishness has gotten a very bad rap. I think it's a wonderful thing as long as it's done in a healthy manner where, you know, the self is represented in the relationship. Otherwise, you are just simply, you know, a tool that another person uses to perpetuate behaviors that do not serve them. So really, as soon as you take on the responsibility for emotionally regulating another person without their consent, you're in codependence. You're not recognizing who that person authentically is. You're not allowing them to express themselves as their authentic selves. What you're doing is trying to create an environment that you feel comfortable in. And so you completely lost sight of who's standing in front of you.
Right.
You know?
But it really isn't healthy to assume emotional regulation over someone who hands that over to you either.
No, absolutely not. Because what you're really reaffirming in them is they don't have the ability to regulate themselves, and you're creating dependence. And then they can only regulate when you're around. And that's dysfunctional. That's not love. That is making yourself so necessary that other person actually has to have you to be there to be who they are. And it's an illusion. You know, as individuals, you know, as we become adults, we really do have the ability to emotionally regulate ourselves. It really is our own responsibility through a deep understanding of who we truly are. And, you know, when I talked about selfishness, I mean really knowing self, having a deep understanding of who we are, what we want, where we want to go, what we like, what we don't like. In that surety, in that knowing of self, then we can truly represent who we are to another person. If we start shifting and changing according to what somebody else needs, what we're really doing is manipulating them. We're not letting them know us at all. And there's no vulnerability there because there's no true self there. When you can actually be solid in who you are, who you know who you are, and emotionally present yourself that way through a vulnerability and a compassion and truly accept another person to be there, that's when you can truly move into a loving and safe relationship where you're fully accepted and loved unconditionally.
Right. Right, and of course that like really borderlines my whole soapbox of personal responsibility.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm standing on that soapbox with you, so move right on over.
For my loyal listeners, you know, if I get a chance to slip that in there, I'm going to do it because that's definitely, you know, that's my soapbox. And I so believe that once we each take personal responsibility for ourselves and we're acting, you know, in our authentic selves and we are honoring ourselves, then, you know, that is that's the creation of peace on earth, because it just is going to, if it works for us and it works healthy for us and we're loving ourselves, then it just, it's a domino effect.
So. Absolutely. And, you know, you're really moving into external and internal locus of control. And people with an external locus of control, like, for instance, when you're a baby, that's appropriate. You are completely dependent on your external environment. And that's actually where limbic resonance develops. You know, how the mother interacts or the father interacts with the child teaches them how to self, you know, regulate. But there comes a point where that self-regulation becomes mature. And in that, that's where personal responsibility comes in. That's where, you know, the child can move off and go to college and be secure and accomplish the things they want in their life. That's where they detach their complete dependence to their parent, become an independent individual with the ability to truly love and be vulnerable in their relationships. Unfortunately, if that has not been put into place, then people have difficulty moving away, and they have difficulty finding that dependence, and they start searching out relationships or codependent relationships so that other people can define them. You know, and that's where, you know, your midlife crises and all those wonderful things come into play, because you truly don't even know who you are. And, I mean, out of everyone in the world that needs to be known, we need to know ourselves and understand ourselves. Otherwise, we're chaff in the wind. We're blown by, you know, whatever externally is around us is who we are. And there is absolutely no foundation. When you truly know yourself, then you are solid. You know, you are firm, or as, you know, your feet are on the ground. And you can navigate every situation from a truth, from a core understanding of what it is you're willing and unwilling to participate in. And that's where true authenticity comes in. It's not about judgment. You know, you and I have done judgment and discernment. It's really discerning. You know, when you're externally represented, you're in a constant state of fight and flight because there's no solid foundation under your feet, and you have no idea where you're going next. And then you got to judge. This is bad. I have to run from this, or I need to be angry about this, or I need to hate this because it threatens me. When you're in that solid place of discernment, you can look at something with compassion, see it fully for what it is, understand what it is you'll participate, not participate in, and then make a solid decision based on your personal choices, not whether someone else is good or bad. Mm-hmm. And that allows them freely to be who they are and allows you to be freely who you are and interact in a way that is healthy, you know, with those healthy boundaries, with that sense of secure and safety within the self. And that's, you know, where your healthy adults come from, when that's really given to a child, you know, allowing them to test who they are and explore who they are and make mistakes and just, you know, allow them to discover who they were meant to be. and take with them, you know, that support and love and compassion and that freedom to be vulnerable and make mistakes and learn. That's, you know, that's where they grow up to be these healthy adults, and these are the adults that can go out into the world and allow others to do the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, it's kind of been funny because throughout the show, I've just kind of wanted to say, you know, like with babies, and you were saying that limbic resonance starts off, like we start developing that in the infant stages. And babies and animals are such a good, decent judge of character. Like, they'll know if someone's upset, or they'll know, you know, if something's really off, and they'll fuss or they'll cry, and they'll know if there's somebody that's just giving them love. And they'll also know if they need to give that back. I mean, it's just like, you know, as they're gazing into someone, they'll know if they're shifting vibrationally what's going on. And I've just been driven the whole time, and I already pretty much know the answer, but it's like, it's almost like you wish you had, like, some little internal system, like a baby crying, that could say, beep, beep, there's something off about this interaction, you know, in your body. And we do have it. We each just have to decide what it is and understand it and know what our bodies are saying. But, gosh, if we could just get that mechanism to be as simple as, like, the cry of a baby so that everyone could identify it, you know, outright and be able to switch whatever it is they're taking in.
Yeah, and, you know, I totally agree with you. We do have it, and I believe it's ever present throughout our entire lives. It's just whether or not we're willing to listen to it. You know, I see so many people describe themselves as empaths. And, you know, these are people who have highly developed their emotional intuition. But really, I think that every living human being has the ability to be an empath. You know, it's what you focus on developing. And in our society, we're so into developing our brains and our knowledge. And, you know, we really have such an absence of emotional intelligence. And many times we move into situations and we may feel something's completely wrong. But according to social rules or whatever else, we override that emotional intelligence and make decisions based on, you know, what would be the right thing to do, what would Mary do. You know what I mean? We move into these situations and we make decisions that we later regret. Because, you know, our emotional body is such an incredible aspect of intelligence. So much information is picked up through our limbic system. And it's almost as if you're reading a book and covering half the page and then just turning it. You know, it is such an essential aspect to really, truly understand your environment, what's going on in our environment, and to really utilize that along with what we have learned, the associations we have made, you know, what we choose to see in our life, what are our goals. With all that information, we can fully be present to a situation. If you've cut off your emotional body, and believe me, if you're numbing any part of your body, whether through, you know, completely cutting off a relationship because it's unsafe, or through alcohol or drugs or anything like that, you're numb completely. You cannot numb just one aspect of your life and be open everywhere else. It's an all or nothing thing. And so, you know, that's where that vulnerability and being willing to be present is so important. And we have that. It's just a choice of whether or not we choose to develop it or not.
Yeah, you know, that is so key, and that's such a good reminder that we can't just shut down part of our lives. It affects all of us. So that was just such a perfect reminder for me. Thank you very much for pointing that out. So we are down to like the last 9 to 10 minutes of our show. Is there anything that you wanted to share with the audience that you want them to know about this, or some topic that you don't feel like we covered? Or, I mean, and it can be on limbic resonance. It could be anything you feel like you want to get out there and share with the world.
You know, just the one thing that keeps coming up over and over again in the things that I'm studying and what I'm looking into, the one thing I'm finding is so important is get a complete understanding of what it is you want to see in your life. Once you see what that is, take the time to really feel what that would be like. And once you generate that feeling, trust your feelings, trust your emotions, trust your beliefs, but also be willing to find someone, make connections, and make healthy connections. And, you know, initially, if you're concerned about not being able to do that, find somebody who can help you do that, whether it be a therapist, a mentor, whatever. But find somebody with the reputation, you know, the street credit of really being a healthy individual that moves through their lives with love and compassion. And spend time with that person. You know, so many times our lives and our past and our losses really cause us to disconnect. And, you know, where it's just, I don't know, it's just so essential to connect to others. You know, take time to meet people's eyes. And before you look away so quickly or whatever, take a moment to see what that feels like, to really connect to another human being. And, you know, for me, the biggest thing, you know, for parents is take time to play with your children. You know, it's not about the big things, the King's Dominion and the fancy vacations. You know, pull out a game of Monopoly and play with your children and give them time to talk to you and get to know you. You know, in my mind, as you know, I have such a heart for children, and they're just so important to our future, and spending time with them. You know, make dinner with them. If you're fixing a car, call them out to hand you the tools. Just spend time with them. So important. And allow them to really learn what it is to be fully supported and loved.
Yeah, you pull out a pot and a pan and a wooden spoon and create a band. Yeah, it doesn't take a whole lot, does it?
No, it really doesn't. You know, so many parents that, you know, you and I work with are so economically depressed. And I hear over and over again, we just can't give them the things they want. And I tell them, you know, those are wants. Those aren't needs. Sit down and love your child. It's not about, you know, the fancy car, the iPod. Those are nice, and yeah, they're fun, and yeah, their friends have them. But I'll tell you what, you know, my brother has an incredible relationship with his daughter, and they're not affluent, and they live in a very, very affluent society. But all the children play at my brother's house because they just say that when they walk in, they just feel so comfortable and so, you know, accepted, and they love to hang out with my brother and my sister-in-law because, you know, there's just such an appreciation for the individuals, who they are, and there's not an expectation to live up to someone else's expectations. You know, they're just allowed to be and have fun and, you know, in a healthy way. I mean, there's definitely rules and guidelines, but there's just not a lot of that pressure that so many of our kids feel today. And, you know, just if parents knew, just love your kids. You know, I know we're busy. We're stressed, you know, especially during these economic times. We can get so caught up in what's going on with us and what it is we want, that we lose sight of these incredible human beings that are standing in front of us that really need so much from us to really learn how to be healthy adults. And, you know, just like you said, pull out a wooden spoon, throw a stone in the soup, and read Stone Soup, you know, and talk to them about community and look at them and appreciate them for who they are, even if they're being naughty.
Right. Well, you know, really, Michelle, and for anybody that's out there listening, for anyone who's ever lost anybody, you know, you don't think back on, oh, gosh, all the things they could have provided for me. You stop and you think back about the time that, you know, you spent with them and the time that you're missing being able to spend with them because they're no longer here. So when push comes to shove, it's not about material things, and it's not about how much money you have. It's about time. And here it is this whole scientific, you know, connection, this limbic resonance that starts at birth and goes on through life, and that can be changed at any point in our lives, you know, either way. You know, I mean, it can hopefully be changed for the better, but it can also be changed for a more negative aspect. But, you know, we have the ability to control and change it, and it's just a matter of making the choice to do so.
Yes, it really is. And you know, you're so right, Lynn. As you know, I lost my father when I was very young, and I honestly couldn't tell you a single Christmas present he ever gave me, but I could tell you the exact moment and the smell of his favorite leather chair when I used to sit on his lap and talk to him about my day. And, you know, those are the memories I keep of him and spending time with him and just, you know, that one-on-one connection. It's not about what we give them materially. It's what we give them emotionally and how present we are to those that are just so important, not only to our family, but to really our future. And to each other, you know, with your spouse or with the one that you love, your partner, take time to really be present to them emotionally. You know, look into their eyes and tell them that you love them, that you accept them. See them fully for who they are and realize that, you know, you're wanting to be fully seen for you, who you are as well, and totally accepted. And just be present to that relationship, and it can do amazing things.
Right, right. Well, Michelle, I want to thank you so much for taking your time out to be here with us on the show today. I greatly appreciated it, and I certainly appreciate your wisdom, not only today on the show, but, you know, in my life in general. Thank you again so much for being here.
Well, I really appreciate being invited, and as you know, I call you all the time because, you know, you just are, you're just a friend of good counsel, and I just so I'm just so lucky to have you in my life, and you know, we're on this journey together, and it's exciting, and you know, I learned so much from you, and I love the work that you're doing. I think it's so essential, and I'm just really looking forward to seeing how that develops.
Perfect. Perfect.
In our lives. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And again, thank you for being here. And for all of you that are out there listening, I thank you so much for being here with us today and hope that you will join us again in 2 weeks. Have a fantastic week, and we'll see you again soon.